grateful member of Allen. It's a privilege to be here with you guys tonight. I appreciate the invitation. Thanks to Nick for hosting my wife and I, and Molly for dinner. We had a great time. You know, the first time I got asked to speak, I went to my sponsor. I said, "Hey, Jerry, they're asking me to speak. What should I do?" And he says, "Well, don't lean on the podium. Don't swear. Don't drool. That's what I got." So that's my plan. I do have a plan, and it's one of the reasons that I'm in Allen. I have a plan for all of you too. You know, my story starts with my dad. My dad came up through the Depression, and he didn't have very much when he was growing up. And his job, as he saw it as being a father, was to provide better for his family than it had done for him. And you know, as a dad, I know what that's about. I wanted to do better for my family. For my dad, that was money. So every time he had an opportunity to work somewhere to make more money than he was, he took it. And that meant we moved a lot. And moving is one of the hallmarks of my story. I went to four elementary schools, one junior high, and three high schools. When I moved into the house that I moved into about a year and a half ago, it was my 43rd move. And you know, when I was small, we always seem to move in the middle of the school year. And I don't know if you've had the experience, but if you walk into a classroom in the middle of the school year, the eyes are on you, and you didn't get a chance to assimilate with the place, and you're the outsider. You know, back when I was in third grade, the dinosaurs roaming the earth, and pencils were this big, you know, we sorted stuff out on the playground. And so I went out on the playground, and I got my butt kicked by the bullies, and I went home, and this kind of ragtag, my dad said, "What happened to you?" And I said, "Well, you know, the bullies kicked my butt." And he got down on his hands and knees, and he balled my hands open to fists, and he said, "This is your left, this is your right, this is how you use them. Fight's not over to one of you doesn't get up." And you know, I was way more afraid of my dad than I was his kids on the playground. So the next time we went out there, we went out and sorted it out. And you know, what I was really learning to do was to keep people away from me. And I didn't understand that at the time, but that's what happened. So we moved a lot. By the time we got into high school, you know, by the time I was in my last high school, I was really kind of exhibiting passive aggressive behavior. I just wanted out of school. I wanted to be able to do the things that I wanted. You know, in my family, we're a nuclear family because we moved so much, everything stayed in our house. But I also grew up with the isms and the disease. My dad drank every day, and I'm not going to call him an alcoholic. I never saw him drunk, but he drank every day. But we had the isms and the disease. What happened in our house stayed in our house. We didn't talk about what was going on inside there. You know, in my family, if they asked you, "How are you feeling?" they wanted to know if you had a fever. That's just the way it was. And so, you know, by the time I got to high school, I was doing well in classes and getting A's and I'm flunking other classes. And they called my parents in and said, "You know, the kid's capable and we don't know what's going on." And the truth was, I just wanted out. When I was 16, I got my first job in my house and made the money. You got to use the money any way you wanted. That's control. And we're going to hear a lot about control for a while here. So I got my first job working. I finally got out of high school. My grades weren't good enough to go to a four-year college, so I went to a junior college and I started my own business. I was cleaning apartments for real estate leasing companies. And we'd clean apartments and all, we got paid cash. And we were making some pretty good money. My grades got up. I went up to San Jose in California to a four-year school. I majored in psychology with a minor in sociology. I was working two jobs because I was like my dad, I didn't have money, and one of my jobs was I was a dispatcher for the state police. So I met this girl in college, and I'm working these two jobs, and we got kind of serious, and one day I'm dispatching her, and she calls me at the office and says, "My dad just had an against the fence with a gun threatening to kill me." And I did what I knew how to do, and our family would take care of our own. I rolled a couple units over there, this guy got arrested. And I went to her after my shift and I said, "What was that about?" She said, "My dad's an alcoholic. And this is what happens. This is how, you know, he behaves." Didn't even consider it. All I needed to know was I needed to keep this guy away from my girlfriend, right? That guy later died of the disease. He died of alcoholism. So we get pretty serious. We're getting ready to graduate. We decide we're going to be a couple. And I get my degree and I go to work in the field of psychology. I start working as a therapist. you know, I had a problem with that because all these people coming to see me were screwed up. I was probably ill-equipped to deal with it at the time. So I made a decision that all budding humanitarians make. I joined the Marine Corps. Now, the truth of that was, my dad was a pilot in World War II, and up on the wall in our house, he had his wings and his blood chips on the back of his jacket, and his medals and stuff. But he never talked about that, because we just didn't talk in our house. But I knew that that had a profound effect on him, and I wanted to fly. So I joined the Marine Corps on an aviation contract. I picked my bride and moved back to the East Coast again and start to go through training. And I get down into Pensacola, Florida, and get ready to go to flight school. And you have to take three tests before you can start flight school. You have to pass aerodynamics, physics, and algebra. Well, I passed physics, I passed aerodynamics, and I flunked algebra. And the truth was, is I flunked algebra because I didn't care about it in high school. It was one of those classes that was just, you know what, I just went out, I want to do this. And I got called into the commandant's office. He said, you can't fly if you don't pass algebra. So they sent me to what they call stupid study, and I sat down with guys who were way smarter than I was, and in 3 days I learned algebra. You know, and that taught me something. Those deficiencies that I thought I had, if I work hard enough, if I apply myself, I can achieve. And you know, the Marine Corps gave me three other gifts. They told me, you know, if you're in a situation that you've never been in before, you adapt. Regardless of the obstacle that's in front of you, you overcome. And if you don't have what you need, you improvise. And I took those three things to heart, and I went into training really well. I went into advanced jets, finished at the top of my class. And in the Marine Corps, it's a meritocracy. They have a lineal list, and everybody has a ranking from the best down to the worst. And if you want to fly in the Marine Corps, if you don't want to fly helicopters, you have to graduate towards the top of your class. And I knew I wanted to fly jets, and so as I started to study, I really applied myself. And I finished at the top of my class in primary, I finished at the top of my class in secondary, went into advanced jets. And that's control, right? If I'm at the top, I don't have to worry about what's going on with the guys down the street. I did really well. I got to pick the airplane that I wanted because I graduated at the top of my class. First guy gets his choice. And I instinctively and consciously chose an airplane that had one seat in it. And I did that because I'm the only guy that can make that airplane do what I wanted to. Nobody else can touch anything. Whatever happens is my responsibility. So I went out and started to fly this airplane. I took my bride in 1980. My daughter was born. She's born in Meridian, Mississippi. Her name is Brianna. You're going to hear about her a little bit later. And we get in there, and I go through the replacement air group, and I get into the fleet, and I'm doing really well. I mean, I'm throwing airplanes around the sky. I'm doing some really remarkable things. I poured myself into building my career. And you know, one day I came home and my first wife said, your services are no longer required. And I'm just like, what? You know, I'm a captain of Marines, I'm leading strikes, I'm planning strikes, I'm wearing these good-looking uniforms, throwing these hot rods around. And, you know, she wanted a divorce. So I went through that divorce, and I got to tell you, I was really irritated by that. In fact, I was grateful. Because I wanted to be the better dad. I wanted to take care of my daughter and be the best dad I could be. And at the time, the Marine Corps and the legal system and our good judgment would not give a single combat pilot a daughter for custody. There's just no way I could take care of her. So I had to sign my daughter over to my first wife. And, you know, I was really rageful about that. And, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with rage, but real rage is not the guy on the corner screaming and yelling. Real rage is cold, it's quiet, and it's calculating. Real rage is a guy that sits in the back of the room like I did and said, you know what? I'm going to fix it. Sooner or later, there's going to come a time when I'm going to get a chance to get my daughter, and I'm going to wage a campaign to do that. Now, waging a campaign in the Marine Corps is called a full frontal assault. It's the only thing they do when they're really good at it. And you know, I had learned since I was in third grade that if the obstacles get your way, you bully and bash your way. So, I had lost my first life, and I thought, well, I like women, might as well find another one. So I did what Marine Corps pilots do. We go to honky-tonks and look for women, right? And I was at a honky-tonk one night, and there's a I like to dance. At that time, there was no country dancing. I like the whole world as well. I'm dancing. There's a really cute girl out there. She's got long hair, got a southern accent. She's out there dancing. I asked her to dance, and we started going out and dancing around the floor. And, you know, as a single pilot, there's a question that you wait for, right? And that question is, what do you do? I know she's going to ask. It's my best part. So we're down there dancing and having some drinks. And finally, she says, well, what do you do for a living? I puff myself up. I'm a Marine Corps fighter pilot. And she says, at least you got a job. The level of competition I was dealing with at the time. And I never heard that response, and it was a challenge to me. That lady's with me tonight. I'm going to introduce her to her. So we start going out, and you know, I do what I know how to do. I fully disclose my position. I'm a single Marine Corps pilot. I've got this daughter from another marriage. If I get the opportunity, I'm going to give it back. We started to talk about the contracts of life, because that's what I understood how to do. And we decide we're going to get married, and we get married, full Marine Corps wedding, the sword arch, and the whole nine yards. And we come to a point where I decided to separate from the Marine Corps because I wanted to build the American dream. You know what? I went out and I started to interview with a lot of companies. And, you know, my money was important to my dad, so it was important to me. And I interviewed with a lot of companies, and there's one company that says, you know, Gordy, we're not going to pay you salary, but you can make as much money as you can. He said, that's the good news. The bad news is there's no salary. He said, they showed me some guys who are making some pretty good money. And you know, Marine Corps taught me, if you can do it, I can do it. So I signed on with that company, and I took my wife and moved up into Washington State and started to build the American dream as I understood it at the time. So we're in this new relationship, and I'm working and building a business. And my daughter came up for a 3-week visit from California. And that 3-week visit turned into a year. And I knew at that point I had a tactical advantage. I had my daughter in my custody, my ex was down in another state. I went into Seattle and I interviewed a bunch of lawyers and said, hey, this is my situation, I want you to get my daughter back. And this one guy says, I can get your daughter back. And I told him, I don't care what it costs, I don't care what it takes, I want you to get my daughter back. So, by this time, Connie and I bought our first house. Had my daughter with me, and we started in this custody battle. My wife's name is Connie, and Connie says, well, you know, I'd like to have a child of my own. I said, you know, I'm a Marine, I don't know how that works. And our son was born after that. His name is Travis, and you can hear about him. He was born in 1986. So now I've got a son, I've got a daughter, I've got the house, and I've got a brand new Toyota Camry, I've got a golden retriever. I'm building a dream, right? Well, you know, about this time, my life was starting to get chaotic. There was some craziness going on in the house, and I attributed that to being a blended family and being in a custody battle. But the truth was, that's when alcoholism started to show in my life. You know, Connie and I would start to argue a lot, and the house was full of tension. And you know, I didn't know what a fair fight was. And the way that I was trained, I used to teach my guys, if you're in a fair fight, you have to plan it right. So I would do what I knew how to do, is I would store up all the stuff that I would take my wife's inventory, and when we got into a fight, I would unload on her with that. And you know, it's what I knew how to do. And we're going to talk about how I do that and how we do things differently, but things were nuts in our house. We got custody of my daughter. I'm building my business now. We won the legal situation, my son, my daughter, and things are going on. But you know, there's a lot of tension and some weird stuff happening in our lives. My wife would come home and park the car on the lawn. Park the car in the neighbor's lawn. You know? That's just not normal stuff. That wasn't happening to the neighbors. And so we're sitting there, and I'm trying to figure this stuff out, and you know, I usually have a plan, right? So there has to be a plan to figure this thing out. And I start paying attention to what's going on, and it's pretty clear to me that Connie's been, you know, she's drinking a lot, and we're talking about the situations that are going on, the fights are getting worse. And the truth is on the outside, our lives look really good.
I'm a football coach, I'm a baseball coach, I'm a softball coach, I'm a cut master, I'm a pack. I'm highly involved, right? The outside looks good, but inside my family is dying. It is sickened by the disease of alcoholism. So, moving further down the line, Connie and I are talking one day, and she decides that she has a problem with alcoholism, or a problem with alcohol, and she's going to go to AA. Now, in my world, it was black and white, problem, solution. But you know, she goes to AA meetings, and she'd come home, and she'd be hammered, and then it was truly frustrating for me. And I get serious about going down there and telling those guys how to do your job. She's just supposed to be sober, she's not supposed to be drunk. It is funny, but it isn't. And things just kept getting worse. The loss of jobs, the bizarre behaviors is getting worse and worse. The relationship is getting further and further apart. The defining event of alcoholism in my life took place in February of 1997. My brother's a physician that lives in a town right down the road from us. And I'm at work, I'm out in the field, and I have one of those Motorola flip phones. Remember those? You flip them open, and you talk on it for 3 minutes, your hands on fire because the battery's so hot. You had to be somebody. I was somebody. I have one of those. And my brother calls me on my cell phone and says, "We've got Connie down here in the ER. You better get down here. We don't know if she's going to live." And my wife had consumed enough alcohol that they were afraid that she was going to stop breathing and die. Now, I was 50 miles away from the hospital at the time, and I can tell you I've been to a lot of meetings and conferences, and I've heard about blackouts. I had an emotional blackout. I did not remember driving to the hospital. The next thing I remember is walking into the hospital. And I'm walking into the ER, and they're trying to get me to sign the papers, and I walk in the room, and we got my wife laying on the stone, and she's got two large four IVs in her. You know, you got to sign these papers so we can intubate her because we think she's going to stop breathing, she's going to die. You know, my world stopped. I don't know if you've ever had that experience. I could see everything going on around me. I could hear people. I couldn't move. All I could see was my wife on this table. And I will tell you, that is the moment that alcoholism became real for me. So I got to sign these papers, and she was laying there, and I'm telling you, I have never seen a body that still would live. But they got kind of stabilized, they got right in the room. I had to go home that night, and I called my parents and said, "Come pick up my kids. Come get the kids, because I'm not going to be there." My parents picked up my kids and were taking care of them. And I got home that night and had to tell them that their daughter, my kid's mother, had almost died from alcohol, drinking alcohol that day. And I got to tell you, that was a humbling experience, because as a man, I'm supposed to make sure things like that don't happen. So, I went up to see Connie the next day, and I didn't have a plan. She was talking about treatment centers, and this was my plan. I went up and told her, "Here's the deal. You can go to treatment. I'm going to put a bunch of money in your hand. I'm going to put you on an airplane, and I don't want to see you again." So, she chose to go to treatment, and I drove her up to treatment that night. Actually the next day, and I drove up to treatment, and I dropped her off, and you know, my overwhelming impression of that drive coming home was how quiet it was in my car. For the first time in years, I wasn't worried about my wife. I knew she was in a place where she wasn't supposed to be drinking, and they were going to take care of her. I didn't have to worry about the after effects and how it would impact my life. You know, when I do newcomers meetings or first step meetings, I tell people living with a disease of alcoholism is like living in a hurricane. But if you've been trained the way I am, you improvise, adapt, and overcome. And you know, the disease doesn't come on full force. It builds slowly over time. So I adapted to it, and I improvised. And I learned to live with the craziness of the disease, but I did not learn to overcome. So I get home at night. My golden retriever was with me. She was went everywhere I went. And, you know, our dogs are like people to us. I go into the kitchen. I'm making mechanic soup because I haven't eaten in 2 days. If you're in Al-Anon, you know what that's about. We'll give ourselves a way to make sure everybody else is okay. And I start making the soup, and my dog looks at me and lifts her eyebrows and says, "You're nuts." It's my second moment of clarity. You know, I realized when my dog's sitting there looking at me that everything that I had been showing the world was built on sand. I'm an analytical thinker. Everything that comes into my my head is a box. I put it in my, I put these boxes in my head. I pull them out one at a time, and I work on them, put them back in. And my relationship with my wife had been so painful, I couldn't look at that box anymore. I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't have a solution. I didn't have a plan. And these boxes are laying on the floor, and it's like, I'm in serious trouble. So I go to the treatment center and walk into the first, you know, the family meeting. They say, hey, I'm bored. You know, here to help. I said, I'm going to sit down. I said, no, I'm here to help. I said, what can I do? They said, you need to go to Alan. I said, whatever. What can I do? They said, you need to go to Alan. And, you know, I sat in that meeting in that room and heard about Alan and handed me a schedule. And the counselors came up to me after that. She said, don't come back until you go to Alan. Tuesday, March 11, 1997, it's the first time I walked into an Al-Anon meeting. I pulled up in front of the Zen church. It's a problem for me. I open up the door, I start walking down the hall, and people are laughing. You know, I'm dealing with some serious stuff in my life. You people need to focus. I walk into the room, and they're hugging. You come over here and hug me, I'll knock you out. So I went in, sat down again. Center, they said to come to a meeting. Oh, wow, first step meeting. So they go through this first step meeting, you know, going around the corner. There's no other guy in that meeting. By the time it gets to him, he looks at me and says, you know, Corey, you're going to say your wife goes to treatment doesn't mean she's going to get sober. I look at this guy, you do not understand the plan. You and I are going to have a problem. So I go back after the meeting, you know, get cards and stuff, and I go back and announce I have been to an Al-Anon meeting. This counselor pulled me aside and says, Gordon, you need to get a sponsor. And what is that? That's the person you work with at the meetings. You're going to work the steps with them, shirts with shirts, skirts with skirts. Don't come back without one. I love that lady. I don't know her name, but I can still see her face. So I go back to the Tuesday night meeting. I walk in, sit down, and there's one guy. And it's him. I know how to take orders, I know how to give orders, so I walk up after the meeting and say, hey, tell me I need a sponsor, will you sponsor me? The guy says, sure, I'll sponsor you, here's my card. He hands me his card, he's the last arrow in his town. Ooh, most people. Let me introduce you to the boarder who was there last night, or that night. I look at this guy's card, and I look at him, and there are only two kinds of airplanes, fighters and targets. You ain't flying a fighter, this is going to be easy. I've never been so wrong in my life. So I started working with my sponsor, and we were talking about this again. When he first started, when he started Al-Anon in Idaho, and when he went there, all the men who went to Al-Anon were dual members, and he sponsored out of the big book. So the first time I went through these steps, I went through with the big book. Today I sponsor guys, and I work exclusively out of the Al-Anon board. But one of the way they sponsor guys is, Gordy, I want you to call me every day. I want you to go to three meetings a week. I want you to read your literature. I want you to pray. I'm thinking 3 hours before every day. 7:50, that'll get you to Hall of Fame in anybody's Because I was looking to pray. I had in my mind that I was not a religious person, and I didn't know what spirituality was. So I started working with this guy, and we have what we call meet-and-needs, where we sit down once a week and then we talk about stuff. And I got to tell you, I was at a sponsorship conference a few years ago, and we were talking about the way that we sponsor people, and talking about the mechanics, and I said, yeah, this is the way I sponsor people. And this lady came up after the meeting, got right in my face and started panting, and I'm like, you're a nonsense sponsor. I'm okay with that. And I'll tell you why. If you listen to the kind of guy I am, if somebody handed me his card and said, call me when you feel like it, I would never call that guy. I would never have had the courage to pick up the phone and say, help. But he gave me direction. And you know, my sponsor never punished me. He always gave me correction and direction. And I am eternally grateful for that. And I sponsor my guys the same way. If it doesn't work for them, more power to them. I'm okay with that. But if you work with me, this is the way I'm going to do it. We start working where they needed me, and you know, told me, he says, here's your first mantra. We'll be kind, we'll be considerate, we'll be tolerant. And I promise you, that had never been on my resume. And then he started telling me, he says, you know, Gordy, your kind's got a higher power, and you're not in. my asset died. When I got to Al-Anon, my street went from horizon to horizon. We were on it, and I didn't like what was going on. We were going to have a conversation. So we start working through this, and you know, we start to work the steps, and you do the reading and literature, you answer the questions, and then we journal. I wanted to write down my first step was, you know, powerless over alcohol, and my wife was unmanageable, because that's what was going on. He says, no, I'm not going to do it that way. We're going to do it this way. So we did the first and second step. And the second step, he introduced me to a concept of a higher power. And you know, I was one of those guys that had faith until I made it. For a long time, my higher power was the groups and my sponsors, because that's where I got the guidance and the love that I needed to make a change like I needed to make. We did the third step. And I got down and he says, okay, we worked through it. He says, okay, now we're going to read the third set of prayer and we're going to do this one on our knees. And I looked at him and I said, no, we're not. He says, no, we're going to do this one on our knees. And I got on my knees and I prayed with this guy because I trusted him. And what I didn't understand was he was teaching me what intimacy looked like, what it looked like to work with a man and trust him enough to become vulnerable. And she started writing my fourth set. I don't know if you had this experience, but as soon as I finished that, I started putting him off. Didn't want to do my fifth with him. He called me up one day and said, Gordy, what are you doing this week? I said, nothing. He says, good, pack a bag. We're going to our sponsorship retreat on 10th. Yeah. So all of these guys, and his one, he's all of the sponsors and their sponsors, he's in Montana and Beartooth, and they have a conference. He says, I want you to have your packing, make sure you bring your fourth set. So I packed my fourth step with flat in Montana, this big suburban with a bunch of other guys in the chain pick us up, and they're laughing and hollering and stuff. Don't touch me, man. We get out there, and we get out just about sunset, we drive a couple hours out, and at sunset, their tradition is a circle up, and they say the seventh step prayer. And you know, there's a couple hundred guys holding hands while I'm getting out of this truck, and I'm getting Jesus on that cult. So we get out, and the first meeting is a fifth step meeting, you know, and so they called me up for that meeting. I said, I hadn't done the fifth step. My sponsor's sitting in the first row. And what I didn't understand was that these guys knew what they were doing. Their sponsors were putting them off, and they had a plan. We're going to drag you out in a little bit and just bring your fourth step. We're going to do 4, 5, 6, and 7. You know, I did my first fifth step that night under the stars in Montana. And here's the important part of this one is, you know, for the first time in my life, I told somebody how I thought, how I saw myself. And my sponsor there to see who I thought I was. He saw something different. And you know, it was a profound experience for me. Was it the best fourth step I've ever gotten or fifth? No, it wasn't, but it was the first and it was the most important. And he gave me a list of things that I needed to work on. I did 6 and 7, came back. By now, you know, Connie's been in the program for a while. I've been struggling with 3 laps on and off, and trying to find our feet. Fast forward a little bit, making direct amends to people. We got into 10. But I had a problem when I got to the 11th step because I had not understood what spirituality was. And you know, I got into the spiritual side of the program by going with my sponsor's home and find something he has that you want and ask him how to do it. And that's what I did. And everybody I asked said, we find time to read, we find time to meditate, we find time to pray. And I started to do that in my life. And I had to practice today. It starts every morning. The first hour of my day is mine. Nobody gets it. And I read, I meditate, I pray, and I journal. You know, I'm shortening up your notes, so I want to start talking about some of the things that transpired in our lives in the program. You know, my son's name is Travis. He's slightly shorter than I am, and he's a tremendous athlete. He's really great. And you know, when I got into Al-Anon, he was a little 10-year-old kid who was afraid of his dad because I was dangerous. And my daughter wasn't afraid of me, but you know, in my house it was conditional love. If you didn't do what I thought I needed you to do, I would withhold love from you and make things difficult for you. And I didn't understand what that was until I got to be. You know, today our lives are very different. My wife has got where are you? There she is. That's Connie right down there. My wife has 16 years of sobriety. I don't have to be here. You know, We went through some really tough times with our kids. My daughter had an eating disorder. And that eating disorder was a result of, she lived in two difficult environments, one in my house and one with her actual birth mother. And the only thing she could control was what she put in her mouth. And you know, I didn't recognize that for a long time. By the time I did recognize it, I had learned to ask for help. I used the tools that were given to me. And we found help for my daughter, but the help that we were told to give her made me feel like I was being a bad dad. I wanted to make my head explode. And you know, I had to take direction to follow her, and I did that. And my daughter had to leave the house, and it was not great for any of us. And my daughter had walked out of her disorder. You know, there was a period where my son and my daughter didn't get along, and it was really, really bad at my house. It was one of those. But you know, Al-Anon has taught me that my sphere of influence is about as far as I can reach my hands. And I had a very wise person tell me, you know, your son and your daughter's relationship with theirs, it has nothing to do with you. It's not your side of the sphere. And you know, today they get along, and I have nothing to do with that either. They have to figure that stuff out. Here's the short version of Al-Anon for me. This is my disease. My Al-Anon disease says, I know what you need to do, and if you'll do it, I'll be okay. And if you don't do it, I'm not going to be okay, and I'm going to make you do what I think you should do, so I'll be okay. That's the short version of Al-Anon. And you know, today, most people in my life get to do whatever they want to do. They get to be who they want to be, and I learn what boundaries are and how to stay in relationship with people. And some people in their relationship are very difficult. My wife and I, we built our marriage. We had to find help outside of the program. That's not a recommendation. This is just our story. 5 years in recovery, we both had solid programs. Our lives were going, you know, our program lives were good, but there was not enough in our relationship for me to stay in any with her. And I told her so. And I had a sponsee that was talking to me. And he was using this remarkable language about relationships. Where are you getting this? And he says, I've got this therapist that has 28 years in both programs. I said, give me that number. Well, two reasons I'll tell you is I had to do that to get my marriage back. The other is, if you're a sponsor, you think you're calling a sponsor and you're bothering him, you're wrong. Every time one of my sponsors calls me and he's talking to me, he's talking to me about something I need to be working on. So we got with this therapist, and you know, just think of the toughest book of the Nazi sponsor on steroids very soon. And you know, she understood by the programs and she just threw the flag on us. We did some heavy lifting in there. And my relationship today is better than it has ever been. And it had to be done, it had to be rebuilt. We rebuilt it through the fundamentals of the program and some extra help. One of the things that I have learned to do with Tommy is understand it. I spent a lot of time with my guys, I spent a lot of time in the program, I spent a lot of time doing a lot of stuff, and I need to make time for her. Thursday night is a date night in my house. I told my guys, if you call after 5 o'clock and it's an emergency, call somebody else, try not to pull the trigger until 7:30 tomorrow morning, because I'm not answering the phone. And all my guys have other numbers. Thursday night is ours. We go out to dinner, we get popcorn, we sit on the couch, we watch movies, and we don't talk to anybody. And you know, I had to learn how to do that. I had to be taught what gentleness and intimacy looked like. When I got into Al-Anon, I was student French, balls to the wall, hard charging brain. And you know what I found out is the majority of that stuff is service. It's to keep you out there so I'm going to be okay and you don't get to hurt. Al-Anon has taught me how to become vulnerable and talk about the things that are really going on in my life. And my life is far different than I ever thought it was. And it's far better than I ever thought it was going to be. Football is a huge part of our lives. Americans fall back. It's one of my favorite stories is my son. Both of my kids went to Al-A team. They don't go to the program now, but they know where it is. When my son first started in Al-A team and watching baseball, I don't know if you guys remember the Mariners and the Kingo with Lou Piniella. My house is 25 miles straight line from the Kingo. And we were watching the game, and they were calling Bobby Ray out, the worst reliever in the history of baseball. And yeah, you know who he is. And I knew we were going to lose the game, so I'm standing in the middle of my living room, my son's going to bed, and I am giving Lou Piniella the wisdom of my advice at the top of my lungs. And my son sticks his head out of the door and says, did you cause the game in trouble? Woo! retire in a couple of years, maybe next year, and I'm wondering to place value on things in my life. My program, our programs take a lot of our time, but there's a lot of richness in our lives too. I don't hold my relationship up as a model to anybody the way it goes, but you know, there's enough in my relationship to keep me coming back and have long-term plans of where we're going to go. And I owe that to Helen. I owe that to the gifts of a sponsorship and the ability to work through the steps, live through the traditions, and change your life. One of the hallmarks of my program is a reading by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And you know, it says, there's a guidance for each of us, and by lowly listening, you shall hear the right word. Place yourself in the middle of the stream of power and wisdom which flows into your life, and then without effort, you're impelled to truth and perfect contentment. And you know, Al-Anon is not the river of stream of power and wisdom in my life, but it's the headwaters of it. And Al-Anon is the foundation that I believe I've used to change my life. What I've learned to understand is that, you know, I can be vulnerable and take care of myself and be a gentleman. All of that other stuff that was in front of me, that facade I showed the world, wasn't really who I am. I come to understand that I'm actually a very gentleman and caring. And I have a very edgy side. And it's easy for me to move into that if I'm hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. But you know, I've really come to light who I am today. I've always appreciated myself in the way that I've been able to accomplish stuff, but I truly love who I am. I stole this from a lady in our meeting, and I love this. She stole it from somebody else. I've learned to forgive the man I was, accept the man that I am, and pray for the man that I want to be. And you know, I stay in that prayer all the time because I'm not done growing, and I don't intend to stop growing. And it's important to me. So my wish for you tonight is that you find your own stream of power and wisdom, and you find a way to stay in it. Because you know what? I'm not always in the stream of wisdom. There are times when I hit the bank, and there's times when I get out. And when I get out, I do what my sponsor told me to do. He says, okay, Cody, your life's not one, right? You go to meetings, you read your literature, and you pray. That doesn't work. You go to meetings, read your literature, pray, and call your sponsor. If that doesn't work, you go to meetings, read your literature, call your sponsor, and pray. And you know, it's the truth of that. Versus people in here have been in meetings with me tonight, and I'll tell you this, you know, when it's good, right and hard, is this too shall pass? And when it's bad, don't worry about it, because this too shall pass. I hope you find your own river.